Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice. Welcome to Second Opinion, Urologic Oncology Investigators discussing how they apply clinical research in the management of urothelial bladder cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Matt Galsky and Dr. Ashish Kamat, and we've kind of renamed this one to be AUA Follow-Up, the Interface of Urology and Medical Oncology. So, as I mentioned, we have a great faculty, Dr. Matt Galsky from the Tisch Cancer Institute in New York, and Dr. Ashish Kamat from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, where I think the weather is a little bit nasty there today. As always, if you have any questions or comments you'd like to make, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do, there's a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey in the chat room for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We'll learn a little bit about you. We have another webinar coming up on Wednesday, focusing on what's happened in the past year in the management of non-small cell lung cancer in terms of targeted therapy. And then on Tuesday, May the 14th, we'll be back talking about myelofibrosis and what's happened in this past year with Dr. Gerds. Of course, we'll be heading out to the ASCO meeting. As always, we have a whole ton of programs that we're doing there. A couple of them are going to be just a webcast, but most of them will be live for those of you in Chicago, and for everybody else, you can check it out virtually. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program on UBC. But here we're going to be talking about particularly some of the things that happened in the AUA meeting last week, usually of great interest to urologists as always, but also very relevant to medical oncologists. And we're going to use this also as an opportunity to sort of catch up about what's happening in the management of urothelial bladder cancer. Just a caveat that we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and treatments. Please check out the prescribing information. So here's where we're heading. We're going to talk in the beginning a little bit about the interface between urologists and medical oncologists, particularly the relevance of urologists to patients with metastatic disease and the role of oncologists in maybe non-metastatic disease. Then we're going to talk about some of the big stories that have happened over the last year in urothelial bladder cancer. Particularly, we want to get an update from the AUA meeting on the management of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, not only of interest, I think, to urologists, but also medical oncologists. So much great stuff happening there. Really likely to change the face of this disease. And speaking of that, in the second module, we're going to talk about another gigantic move forward, EV Pembro as a systemic therapy, where that's heading implications, obviously, for oncologists, but also urologists. Then HER2-positive urothelial bladder cancer, clearly important for oncologists, but we're going to make the case that urologists really need to know about that, as well as our last brief topic, the current and future use of ctDNA. So again, we started out with this idea, but we're going to really ask the investigators. And to do that, we checked in with our urologic investigators that we usually often use in these situations because they're so great at asking questions and really trying to get to the nitty-gritty of urologic oncology practice. Dr. Jason Hafron from the Michigan Institute of Urology in West Bloomfield, Michigan, and Dr. David Morris from the Urology Association in Nashville, Tennessee. And we actually used these two docs last week in Friday when we did a symposium at the AUA meeting live. Here's Dr. Hafron. But we're going to use a very similar strategy tonight to talk about urothelial bladder cancer. So we're going to start out with a thought and a comment from Dr. Hafron. I'll be really interested to see what the faculty thinks about that. He really brought up a facet of care that I hadn't really thought about, which is the role of the urologist in the patient with metastatic urothelial cancers. So not just bladder cancer. Actually, he was commenting on prostate cancer, but I wanted to save it for this so the two of you could discuss it more, and renal cell cancer. Here's his thought.
When the oncologist gets involved, it just depends on where you practice and what your arrangement. To many, this may seem shocking, but the reality is the community oncologist is completely overwhelmed right now with all the diseases and the complexity of the diseases that they're treated. So as urologists, as champions of prostate cancer, I think we can focus and spearhead these treatments. I'd like to make one point though, Neil, is that when you look at claims data for when urologists is involved in prostate cancer, they're involved all the way from diagnosis to late stage. So I think whether they're delivering the advanced therapies or not, they may be dealing with obstruction or Foley issue or chronic infection. So they're always involved. So I think whether they're treating or applying the therapies or not, I think they need to understand these therapies. They need to understand the adverse events associated with these therapies because they're still treating. And it just depends on your comfort level, whether you're using these advanced therapies or not. The urologist doesn't go away.
So, Matt, I guess Dr. Hafferon's been hanging around us too much because, you know, we focus on the general medical oncologist, the community-based setting, and we know they are having a time. You know, so many things are going on. It's challenging to keep up. But just your thought about what Dr. Hafferon was saying, do you find that your patients, you know, continue to require and go see the urologist, even with metastatic disease, and that they can be an ally in that sense?
I absolutely do. And I would say it probably falls into one of three scenarios, and all of these apply, but they apply differently to different patients. So one, our patients have often been through a major surgery with their urologist, and they trust them implicitly with their care, and their opinion continues to be relevant in later lines of therapy. So we see that interaction continue. We see individuals who do have issues with bladder outlet obstruction, ureteral obstruction, as was commented on, and oftentimes require stent changes. And so that becomes a longitudinal relationship. And then I would say more and more commonly, we're seeing with better systemic treatment that the discussion regarding surgical consolidation is coming up more and more frequently in patients with metastatic disease. Patients with lymph node only metastatic disease with a complete clinical response to systemic treatment, should the bladder be removed? This is a multidisciplinary discussion that's taking place more and more commonly.
So Ashish, I'm curious about your thoughts. I was contrasting with Jason, you know, the role of the breast surgeon in a patient with metastatic breast cancer, which usually once breast surgeries are, yeah, occasionally they may go back, but certainly I think Matt brought up, you know, the ties that a patient develops with a surgeon who goes through such a major procedure. Any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I would add several points to Matt. I mean, Matt made great points, and I could expand on that a little bit too, right? So if you look at the incidence of bladder cancer, the large percentage of patients start out with non-invasive disease, and then the muscle-invasive de novo incidence is relatively small, and the metastatic is even smaller. So where does Matt or a medical oncologist get most of his or her patients from? From the urologist, right? And the urologist is the one that has seen the patient sometimes for 5, 10, 15 years before that patient needs the services of systemic therapy. And I say that because in North America, we urologists under systemic therapy, but in Europe, in Japan, medical oncologists and surgical oncologists share that, right? So the surgical oncologist or the urologic oncologist does the systemic therapy too, whether it's IO or even cisplatin-based chemotherapy. So the large percentage of patients that we refer to the medical oncologist have been seeing us for 10, 15, 20 years, and they will still call me and say, hey, Dr. So-and-so is recommending EV Pembro over GemCis. What do you think? So that's one. The other thing is absolutely true. I mean, bladder cancer has never been more multidisciplinary than today. It always was multidisciplinary, but it was a smaller group of patients. When do we need to remove the bladder? When do we do radiation? When do we combine systemic therapy with local therapy? This patient's been free of disease for 5 years now. Should we take out the bladder? Because the lung and the liver have responded, you know. But now it's even more so, because even for non-invasive disease, the medical oncologist is important. And for the medical oncologist, even in metastatic disease, the urologist is important. So I think it's all about the patient. And it's not like the patient wants to pick and choose sites. So we have to remember, and it's Bladder Cancer Awareness Month, right? May is Bladder Cancer Awareness Month. It's a good time to make that plea that it has to be a multidisciplinary care of the patient.
Well, I didn't know that about that May was Bladder Month, but Are they still growing mustaches in October for prostate cancer? I don't know. I guess they're not doing anything that true.
They are in November, and it's for all of men's cancer. So, yes.
Oh, all of men's cancer. Okay. Well, that's good. All right. So we'll dip into AUA and non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. It's pretty interesting that these docs were nice enough to talk to me, like, I think it was a week before AUA, and we still missed an approval between that week and the AUA meeting. I think it was yesterday or in the last week. But anyhow, it's hard to keep up, as they were saying, not just for medical oncologists, but I think for urologists more than ever. But let's just start with one question that came up as part of that. And this sort of before we get into the intravesicular thing, Dr. Morris brought up an issue to me as a medical oncologist that frankly, I wasn't aware of, but I found really interesting, and I was particularly interested to see what Ashish says about it, and also Matt, whether he looks at the reports. Anyhow, here's the point that Dr. Morris made to me.
I think the main limitation for many bladder cancer trials and therapies is the variability between the therapies themselves in terms of the surgical therapy. There's very difference between TURBT at different centers and different volume surgeons. And it's hard to level the playing field across those different centers. So we really undervalue the importance of TURBT. And these trials can't really account for that very well. So I think it's invigorating a lot of interest from a urology standpoint on what is an adequate TURBT. What are the key pathologic factors in a report, in an operative note that need to be described? What would you describe as sort of the baseline TURBT that should be done in every community setting, because all urologists are doing them? What should we shoot for as kind of the low bar to make sure that we're all having kind of an entry level into these next lines of therapy that is all adequate? I think it's important to have muscle and specimen. I think it's very important to have re-resection for high-grade T1 disease. And those are the basics that often are not done. And we even see it in our own group on referrals in for clinical trials that you don't fit the basic criteria of what is sort of an adequate cleaning of the bladder before you start putting people on drugs.
So Ashish, one of the things I thought after I went back and looked at this was, is this just relevant to the performance of a clinical trial or actually important to clinical management of the patient? Does it make a difference in terms of outcomes?
Oh, Neil, oh my God, you only have an hour. I could talk about this for 5 hours, right? So as part of the International Bladder Cancer Group, we have made a plea and a call to arms for exactly what Dr. Morris is talking about. We've published on this too, right? Because the TURBT is the most important critical first step in the management of a patient with bladder cancer for many reasons, and it's underappreciated. It's often left to the resident or the junior faculty to do. It's the most important step, because if I don't resect the tumor well, that tumor is going to come back, number one. If I don't resect it well enough, I can't give Matt and others that are doing all this lovely tissue-based therapy and tissue-based analyses enough tissue to make sense. It's not good sampling. If I don't do it well, the pathologist can't tell me if there's T1B disease, if there's muscle involvement, if there's lymphovascular invasion, if there's small cell carcinoma, if there's LELC. They can't tell me all of that stuff, right? So if the TURBT is not done correctly, first of all, the results of clinical trials will make no sense, because right now single-arm studies are being allowed for registration purposes. But there I do want to have a caveat, right? Because the FDA, using the guidance of, you know, folks that do this all the time, has appropriately not allowed single-arm studies for papillary tumors, because there, if I do a horrible resection and my neighboring urologist does a phenomenal resection and then the patient goes on a single-arm study, you can't control for that. But in CIS, we leave the tumor in there on purpose so you can actually look at the effect of the drug. So that's how the FDA sort of allowed leveling for how do you control for quality of TURBT. But absolutely, I mean, the resection of the tumor is indeed the most important first step that guides everything, whether it's intravesical therapy, whether it's systemic disease, whether it's a radiation therapy, right? Because we know TMT works better if you do a complete eradication of intravesical tumor. And there are many places where the patient gets radiation with a big bulky mask in the bladder, and no wonder it comes back, right? So I agree 100% with Dr. Morris.
I'd be curious to see what, Matt, whether you look for whether you look at the reports, what you look for. But real quick, as she's Susan in the chat room wants to know, do you see an increased risk or thrombosis in patients undergoing cystoprostatectomy? Ashish.
Oh, yeah. So cysto-prostatectomy, right. I mean, we're 2RBT is the low risk. That's what we're talking about, right? But cystectomy, prostatectomy together, absolutely. There's an increased risk of femoral thrombosis. And for those patients, we do anticoagulation as a matter of routine. So they get anticoagulation prior to induction at surgery, and then we continue it for 30 days after.
Yeah, I think that was a question. She put that question in before you went into that. So, Matt, do you look at the reports and do you ask the urologist about it or not necessarily?
Oh, absolutely. And I would say that everything that I've learned about the importance of TURBTs and the technique I've learned from Ashish. So critically important operation. As a medical oncologist and to the medical oncologist listening, at the very least, if you don't care for bladder cancer frequently, you want to make sure that there's muscle in the specimen, at the very least. Not necessarily muscle involvement. Not everyone has muscle-invasive bladder cancer, but you can't know that if there's no muscle in the specimen.
And Neil, could I follow up on that since Matt made that point? For the medical oncologist listening in, don't hesitate to call your urologist and say, hey, listen, I'm considering whether to give this patient XYZ. I need tissue to do NGS. I need tissue to do this. Is it safe for you to take the patient back because the tissue that we have is not sufficient, right? We will tell you, no, the patient's 95 years old. I mean, we should not be considering XYZ anyways. Or we'll tell you, no, sure, let me talk to the patient and see if he or she is willing to go back in and get some more tissue for you. So have that open dialogue for sure.
Or maybe the urologist could say, could you get away with a liquid biopsy? Just kidding. But anyhow, I mean, more and more, and it's getting better and better. Okay. Here's the beginning of the videos that became outdated a couple of days ago, but you know, not exactly in terms of the question. And Ashish gave Matt and myself a 3-minute update of what happened at AUA in this regard. And that would take 5 hours to get into, but we'll ask him for the bottom line. But here's the beginning of it when Dr. Hafron asked the question that a lot of urologists have.
Currently, we have two products available. We have pembrolizumab for CIS refractory and adalfaragene for CIS refractory disease. My question is, how do you decide when you would pursue pembrolizumab versus adalfaragene in a patient with CIS refractory disease?
How would you answer that question?
In my experience, I would prefer to use an intravesical agent. However, there's significant concerns with these agents as they're very expensive. When you have these patients in your office and you're defrosting a $60,000 drug that you're going to instill into the bladder, it becomes a little intimidating and a little anxiety provoking to make sure that that patient's treated with that drug. Patient may show up with a urinary tract infection. Patient may develop some frequency and urgency and void out the drug. So we take multiple measures to make sure that the drug is used maximally effectively. When would you consider systemic therapy versus intravesical therapy? And then which intravesical agent would you use?
So Ashish, let's do it this way. I mean, let's talk a little bit about what you can do right now. And then after the next tape, we're going to talk about what do you think may be going on in the next 6 to 12 months. But let's just start about where we are right now in terms of the questions that Dr. Hafron had 10 days ago that now we have an additional one.
Yeah, so there's actually 4 approved agents right now for BCG refractory CIS. Not 2 and not 3, but 4, right? So valrubicin was approved in 1998, I believe. It's not used anymore because the results are so poor, but it is approved and some people still use it. It has a 4% response rate at 2 years, and clearly most patients don't want that. Then, of course, there's pembrolizumab, which has about a 19% CR rate at a year, a lot of toxicity. So the trade-off of 19% response for roughly 8 to 10% serious adverse events in the patients that at least we see. Most patients don't want that option, but it's available for patients if that's what they want. Now, when Dr. Hafron was talking, there were still, leaving aside valrubicin and pembrolizumab, there's still 3 options that we can discuss with patients, and now there's a 4th. So first, there is nadofaragene, which is intravesical gene delivery, which is once every 3 months, and that's the one where the pricing information is sort of publicly available at roughly $60,000. It has a 1 year, roughly 24% response rate for CIS, since we're talking about CIS, but it's once every 3 months, right? So for patients that have access issues, and we know in North America, there are patients sometimes that drive 6 hours to get to a doctor, and if they can't do something once in a while, they just don't come. So for that patient, I would say, hey, we have this drug. It only has a 23% response rate, but we'll know in 3 months. So let's give you an instillation, come back in 3 months, and we'll check you out. If that doesn't work, then we'll try to intensify therapy. The other agent that is currently available, or a combination, is combination gemcitabine and docetaxel. To be honest, that is the de facto standard in North America for patients with BCG refractory disease, because it works really well, it's available, it's cheap, and people know how to give it. So that is actually the most prevalent option. And then right before the EAUA, NAI, which is a IL-15 superagonist that's given in combination with BCG and has a 71% CR at 12 months. So the highest of any agent that's approved right now, 71%, was just approved by the FDA. And as of today, at least from what the company says, it is available for use in patients. So a lot of folks obviously need to get that in their formulary, et cetera, et cetera. But today, the discussion with the patient is quite complex. And if I might, Neil, because I know you like to do this, and I know you like to actually talk about, you know, things that are thought-provoking, let me propose to you, there is an agent right now that is currently approved and available. Agent X, with a 75% CR in BCG unresponsive disease and an 86-month duration of response. This was presented at the AUA. Agent X is more BCG. So for some selected patients, you can give them more immunotherapy with BCG and beat all of these approved drugs, and the cost of BCG is so low, right? So there's a lot of options as of right now on Monday, May 6th, 2024, that we can talk to our patients about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I thought you were going to say TAR 200 because those numbers sound like what was presented at TAR 200, but we're going to get to that in a second. Just to come back to you, Matt, first of all, Priya in the chat room says, congratulations, Matt, you made a comment on a board question that was asked in the medical oncology boards that you need muscle in the tissue. I don't know if you write questions for the boards, but she says it was on the boards. But anyhow, Great. Any thoughts about... Yeah, I'm always trying to figure out what, they're usually like 3 or 4 years behind, they're going to be sure everything's right, But so, Matt, what's your perspective again on this situation right now? Is pembrolizumab being utilized anymore?
So I don't see it being used that frequently. I think there are patients for whom it's attractive. As Ashish points out, putting oneself at risk for systemic toxicities for a quote unquote local problem is a discussion that needs to happen thoughtfully. That said, we know that the majority of patients actually don't have major side effects from immune checkpoint blockade, and there are those subset of patients who derive all the benefit and have few to no side effects. So for some patients, it's the right decision, but as we're getting intravesical treatments that have higher and higher response rates with lack of systemic toxicity, the field has been pivoting toward intravesical treatments.
So let's go on to the next question. It really kind of gets into some of the things that were presented at AUA and happening in this scenario. Here's Dr. Morris.
So with the excitement around the phase 3 and pending results of the intravesical therapy with a pretzel, obviously that's a chemotherapy focused one, but there's a pending targeted therapy with erdafitinib also. Are there any trials of specific interest that you're excited to see? Because the pretzel really puts that care directly in the hands of urologists, because we're giving therapy that we might not be able to give in other ways because it's a procedural-based drug. So are there any trials that you're looking for to report out, or specific disease states where you really think that sort of intravesical device really could be something that becomes standard of care?
And, we always have caveats about indirect comparison of, one-arm trials, but sometimes that's all you have. Incidentally, Muhammad in the chat room says, I don't know if this was actually on the boards too, but if you have a negative margin, then you don't need muscle, but this is rare. Is that right, Ashish?
No, that's not true. What the guidelines state is that if it's a T1 disease, a lamina propria involvement, and it's high grade, and you don't have muscle, you must go back in and re-resect. There's no margin issue there at all. So because 40% of those patients will actually be T2, right? So if you don't go back and re-resect, you might be doing intravesical XYZ, whereas they actually need neoadjuvant chemotherapy and cystectomy, and you're undertreating 40% of patients. So, yeah, absolutely, you need to go back and re-resect.
So, Matt, any thoughts? Well, let's go back to Ashish first. Ashish, you know, I for us looking at these non-muscle invasive trials, you know, is a little bit distant as a medical oncologist. But I was looking at that TAR 200 data, like, why isn't this approved? But anyhow, I guess it's not even been submitted yet, but seems like it's very attractive. Can you just give your view of what happened at AUA, what's going on in non-muscle invasive disease, and kind of where you're seeing it evolving over the next really year or two?
Yeah, no, happy to. And again, you know this. I've been involved with pretty much every bladder cancer company, including the one that makes this so-called pretzel. They don't like it being called a pretzel, but we call it that because it looks like a pretzel. And it's a device that you put in the bladder, and it releases whatever you want to put in it. So the TAR 200 is gemcitabine, and it releases gemcitabine at a constant level, kind of getting like the pancreatic cancer metronomic dosing in some ways. So you get the direct cell kill and also recruiting the immune pathway. And TAR 210 is erdafitinib that's put in, and then of course you get the FGFR-directed activity. The most robust data is TAR 200, and that's what you're referring to. And they presented updated data at the AUA, updated from GU ASCO, and of course updated from ESMO. And really, it's small numbers, and that's why it's not approved. They haven't even submitted it, from my understanding, to the FDA, and it's not approved, but it's on the fast track because the results are really exciting. I mean, they're up there in the 75-80% range as far as complete response at any time, and then many of these patients have durable responses as well. So we're all very excited about TAR 200. We're also excited about TAR 210 because in the intermediate risk bladder cancer patients, so that's the low grade patients and FGFR altered patients, the response rates are excellent. Again, very small numbers. So it's like small numbers, great results, and we're all excited about these. Now, there's two other intravesical agents that were presented at the meeting. One is CG0070, which is a cretostimogene, is its generic name. And it's an adenovirus that is GM-CSF coded and targets RB-deficient cells. So there have been two trials. One is with the agent alone intravesically, and one is the agent intravesically plus pembrolizumab systemically. And both were sort of reported with updates. Again, 70% plus CR rates with single agent, 80% plus with the agent and pembrolizumab, which you would expect because they're combining two drugs. And their trial results, or at least the number of patients in the N, was a lot larger than the one with TAR 200, but they too haven't really, you know, been approved yet, but really excited for both of these to be approved. The other one that was reported at the plenary session as sort of a breaking news was EG70, which is a non-viral gene delivery company that has currently RIG1 and IL-12 in their EG70 intravesical therapy. And in phase one results, the response rates were excellent, 60% plus. So they're moved into phase two. And of course, we're one site that's enrolling patients under that. So they reported pretty much the fact that the phase one was sufficient for them to go to phase two and that they're enrolling on phase two. There's other things in the intravesical arena, including EV, which is moving, you know, in its phase one pretty at a brisk pace with excellent results reported already. So great stuff happening. I mean, a lot of stuff happening.
So chat room's all blowing up with questions about the muscle invasive and all. Well, if we'll try to get to that later, like you said, it just stoked their interest, so to speak. Did you say that you said there's a intravesicular enfortumab?
Yes. So it says EV. Yes, intravesical enfortumab. It's a phase one study. I'm PI of that study, but there are many other centers also enrolling overseas and North America. It was a little. The trial was under hold because of the whole acquisition between different companies, as everyone knows, and then it's restarted again. So it was reported at GU ASCO and then at ESMO, and then nothing new till AUA because the trial was on hold because of the, you know, acquisition of the companies, which we don't need to get into.
Matt, any thoughts, any questions? I'm just kind of envision an ADC in the bladder biologically, but anyhow, any thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, whether or not large molecules would penetrate and get in there, I think was a question, but it seems like the preliminary data looks quite interesting. I'd also say in terms of TAR210, I mean, this is a really elegant story. So think about this. This is a disease. So we have erdafitinib in advanced disease. FGFR3 mutations present in about 20% of patients with advanced metastatic disease, given systemically, has some side effects that lead to some unpleasant quality of life related issues, skin and nail side effects. So what if you had a disease where the prevalence of FGFR mutations was several fold higher, and you can give the same drug but without systemic toxicity, give it right into the bladder? And it's a perfect story: non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, intravesical delivery, giving a targeted therapy for a non-invasive cancer. I think this is probably the first example of that.
Very, very cool. And of course, we have several people in the chat room, including Sita, who want to know about enfortumab pembro in the neoadjuvant setting and more about this fabulous and interesting combination. Let's start with a couple of questions from our consultants, beginning with Dr. Hafron.
We overnight have gone from chemo, which we've been doing for probably 20 years, to Evo Pembro. The question is that a reasonable transition to just go right away to Evo Pembro up front prior to cystectomy? It's something that we're considering and seeing being done by some of our oncologists locally. As a urologist that's going to be following these patients, what type of toxicities or side effects should we be aware of when managing these patients? When should we alert our oncologists or our medical colleagues? Because we don't have a lot of experience, especially with EV. We have some experience with Pembro, but I think we need to understand these drugs a little bit better to better serve our patients. In our practice, we commonly use gem cisplatinum as our standard neoadjuvant therapy, but frequently we will find patients that cannot tolerate cisplatinum for usually renal dysfunction. In the era of these pembrolizumab and EV, what chemo regimen would you recommend in someone who cannot tolerate cisplatinum? Historically, when a patient couldn't tolerate cisplatinum, we would just take them to surgery. But with the current new drugs available, should we consider an IO or an EV in this situation? What do you recommend?
So, Matt, it's a really interesting question. How much data in the metastatic setting do you need to be able to apply in the earlier neoadjuvant stage in particular? Obviously, there have been many neoadjuvant trials. Any thoughts? Is it going to take a trial, Matt, or can we do it now?
So I'm certainly optimistic based on the results in the metastatic setting, but in other diseases we've been burned before where results in the metastatic setting did not translate to the perioperative setting. And given the side effect profile of these drugs, I don't think we can be too flexible about making that jump. So we have two phase three studies, KEYNOTE-905, KEYNOTE-B15, one in cisplatin-eligible patients, the other in cisplatin-ineligible. One of those studies has completed accrual, the other not yet, but we will have results from those studies in the not-too-distant future, and I think we really need to wait for the phase three studies.
That's a great point. So Ashish, I'd like you to respond to Dr. Morris's questions about EV Pembro. And also, we were talking, I was talking with Matt earlier, and we put together a little, and part, you know, I said earlier we have this pre-post test. So we put a question in there, which is there anything that a patient on EV Pembro, if they presented with and a urologist saw them, that they should say, hey, you need to talk to your oncologist or somebody now? That was the question. But first of all, let's hear what Dr. Morris has to say.
Obviously, the EV Pembro combination data for kind of metastatic patients is going to quickly morph into the neoadjuvant or perioperative adjuvant setting. From a urology perspective, what are the toxicity profiles that we need to be concerned about when combining therapies for those sort of patients where we may be still seeing them in our clinic? And then on top of that, many urology sites have become very comfortable with pembrolizumab therapy for other indications. And what would be the hurdles you'd be concerned about for us instituting EV Pembro, assuming that down the road it has some sort of perioperative indication, not necessarily metastatic disease, but more aggressive therapy associated along with surgical treatment? Is there certain items that we should be looking for about management or toxicity management or clearance before going on to that certain drug?
So Ashish, you know, sort of starts to get more into this, you know, borderline between the urologist and oncologist and who does what. But any thoughts about this question? And from your perspective, anything that you see in side effects that should cause concern, even if it's a kind of low grade? Because Matt said, agreed with me that dermatologic issues were way up on the list. But what's your thought, Ashish?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you don't want to have someone treated with EV and a rash ignore and the patient end up in the ICU with, you know, fulminant problems, right? Let me just make a comment, right? Because when Pembro came about and it was being like first looked at and approved, there were formal courses at the AUA that I participated in where urologists thought that they wanted it to be trained in the delivery of systemic therapy in their clinics. That has gone away. So most urologists do not want to do systemic therapy, right? So most urologists would not want to take on EV Pembro in their practices because most urologists, whether it's academia or the community setting, have realized that it's a multidisciplinary disease. We need to, you know, be in touch with our medical oncologist and have the medical oncologist deliver systemic therapy. We see the patient. So it's a partnership. So for me, honestly, at MD Anderson, we have no problem, and most people in academia have no problem just picking up the phone and saying, hey, Matt, can you see this patient? I think this patient should get EV Pembro. And Matt will say, I don't think you know what you're talking about, Ashish. I think you should get something else. Or he'll see the patient and give him EV Pembro, right? And I agree completely with Matt. We need to wait for the results of the trial before we move EV Pembro into the neoadjuvant setting. I am excited about it, but I don't think it's ready yet to be given to patients. So as of today, I wouldn't use it in the neoadjuvant setting, but yes, I agree. If there's any urologic practice that wants to take on systemic therapy, it's not just them. They're mid-level providers, the person answering the phone, their residents, fellows, everyone should be trained in how to manage AEs.
So Matt, curious about your thoughts. I would say even if they don't want to be the primary treater, they ought to be well informed about it. I mean, that is the model. You know, breast cancer neoadjuvant therapy is given by the medical oncologist, but the surgeon is seeing the patient. They know what to look for, et cetera, et cetera. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think the things to look for, as you pointed out, a rash, and we take rash very seriously, and we like to look at it no matter whether or not it seems to be mild or not. So certainly if a rash develops in a patient seen by a urologist, the medical oncologist should be alerted. The other is hyperglycemia, and hyperglycemia tends to happen early, but can lead to other signs and symptoms and can become quite serious. So, you know, routine labs checked at the urologist's office and the patient suddenly hyperglycemic, that's something that the medical oncologist needs to know about.
Yeah, that's a great point about the hyperglycemia. So let's venture into the future a little bit. I think the future is now. And we're going to start out talking about HER2-positive urothelial bladder cancer. And here are the initial reactions when I brought this topic up to our consultants.
My guess is that urologists' interest in HER2 positivity for bladder cancer is 2 or 3 years down the line. And I would be surprised if more than 2% of urologists knew about HER2 positivity in bladder cancer. We need to focus on that. Is there anything from your faculty that you would want the urology community to know about HER2 positivity? I don't even know what the percentage of prevalence is in the locally advanced disease setting because we have not historically been looking for it outside of clinical trials. HER2, for those of us who know enough oncology, we know about things that happen in lung and breast kind of, but we need to be ready for when somebody starts asking, well, what's the HER2 staining on this? Because we've never even ordered it. And our pathologists in the community would never even think to send it to us. So we have to be at least ready to be like, oh yeah, there's something I need to be thinking of besides just, is it T2 or T3?
We haven't had any T-DXd treatment yet, but I think with the recent agnostic approval for this drug, it's very appealing, especially in bladder cancer for the HER2 positive patients. I think as urologists, we obviously need to start testing these patients. It's definitely not standard of care, but I'm curious as what markers people are using to test and how they test, as far as what's the cadence of testing. Is it at initial? Is it at recurrence? And what companies are you using to test for these mutations?
So, Matt, here's the approval, April 5th. These things happen very quickly nowadays. So prior to this, we were like all over the place as a CME company. We're trying to talk to the GI people, upper GI, colon, lung, biliary tract as the data was coming out. And then boom, and that was a big enough challenge. And then boom, you have this pan-tumor approval, which is incredibly, unbelievably relevant. Because the way I read it is if you have a patient with a solid tumor and has run out of treatment alternatives and still would like to consider treatment, they better have a HER2 assay on their chart and rule out the positive. And you can start beginning to even talk about how to do that and how to interpret it, particularly once you get outside of breast cancer. So, Matt, we could spend a lot of time on this one as well, but let's start out with the bottom line of what's going on right now, Matt.
So I think with an approval, and this has been of academic interest for some time, HER2 overexpression in bladder cancer, but now we have an approval and that changes everything. And so every patient with advanced disease probably needs to be tested for HER2 expression. This is HER2 expression by immunohistochemistry. The approval is for 3+ overexpression in patients with HER2 3+. Expressing bladder cancers, a refractory disease. The response rate was 56% in the Destiny Pan-Tumor2 study. And so that's a respectable response rate in patients who've exhausted prior treatment, certainly quite a reasonable treatment option. There is activity of trastuzumab deruxtecan in addition to other HER2 ADCs in patients with lower levels of HER2 expression, even 2+ and even 1+. That's not the current approval, but we might see this expand in the future.
So, and I was just flashing on the fact that you and I did a 90-minute program just on HER2 urothelial bladder cancers. So obviously, like all the topics tonight, we're just going to give you the bottom line and hopefully catch your attention about this, because this agent works. I mean, it doesn't necessarily cure people, but a lot of people respond very well. But Matt, one other thing before you... I would like to maybe talk a little bit more about the testing, but because one thing may be a little confusing, which is in breast cancer, if you're IHC 1 or 2+, they reflex into a FISH assay. And then if that's over 2, then that's called HER2 positive also. So the HER2 trials in breast include those patients. A lot of overlap between it. I didn't see anything about FISH in the FDA thing and in most of the trials. So any thoughts?
So that hasn't been part of this program. It is part of the disitamab vedotin program. And so HER2 right. 2+ FISH positive is also considered HER2 high in the DV program. So I think we will be seeing data regarding that category of testing in the future. HER2 expression in bladder cancer is a little bit unusual. It fits somewhere in between breast cancer and gastric cancer. There tends to be membranous expression, but it's patchy expression. There probably is ultimately the need for a specific bladder cancer scoring of HER2. This has been discussed in the community, but for now we use standard scoring.
And you mentioned the disitamab vedotin, which is another antibody drug conjugate. It looks very promising. We have a lot of agents out there with the vedotin delivery. Of course, that's not approved. And this shocking approval just came out. I mean, you know, the lung and the colon people are looking at this too, because, you know, they've had their trials that are ongoing. We've been talking about their trials in lung and, you know, et cetera. And now, boom, you have this FDA indication that just wipes all that out and you're good to go using your, you know, discretion. And here are the potential tumors that we could be talking about. Matt, any comment on sort of where we see this, where the opportunities might be? You know, again, when we think also, you note here, we talk about HER2 mutations. So that's the most common HER2 abnormality in lung cancer. They actually have an indication in mutations, not amplifications, until the pan-tumor thing came through, and now they have that indication as well. Any comments on where this is going to have significant impact, or is it just something everybody needs to know about?
So I think in terms of bladder cancer, certainly something that everyone needs to know about. In one of the interesting things about this ADC, of course, is that it has a different payload than enfortumab vedotin, which is becoming standard first-line treatment. And so a different target and a different payload certainly makes sense to integrate into the treatment armamentarium.
So I'm going to show another question from our consulting faculty in terms of toxicity profiles. And again, this has been a huge issue once we get outside of breast cancer. We actually did a program at the GU Oncology meeting, and we had a segment on HER2 disease, and we actually showed a video of a breast cancer investigator discussing toxicity to T-DXd, because they've been dealing this with years, and the GU people, you know, after that, they were going, oh, we'll do what she just said. But anyhow, here are some thoughts from these docs about the questions they have as particularly T-DXd starts getting used.
The toxicity trade-off for the efficacy is something we just have no reference point in urology. That's a question for the faculty. What is the toxicity of a HER2-targeted therapy? Is it something that we could utilize for more locally advanced disease because it's going to be tolerated better than some of our historical things?
When our patients are being treated with T-DX, what type of adverse events or side effects should we be looking for? Historically in breast, there's been pneumonitis, interstitial lung disease. How does that manifest in our patients? And as a urologist seeing these patients in follow-up, what should we be looking for? And if we do come across these side effects, what should we do?
So Matt, would you like to comment?
So I would say things to look out for are the pulmonary side effects in pneumonitis specifically. So it occurs in about 10% of patients. Most of those patients are not high-grade episodes of pneumonitis, but those can occur as well. Manifests initially as changes on imaging and then ultimately pulmonary symptoms. And so one has to be certainly cognizant of changes on imaging, ground glass opacities that turn up. If you're seeing a patient as a urologist doing your routine scans as part of follow-up, don't realize that, you know, a patient's on another treatment and start to see ground glass opacities in the lungs, that then the medical oncologist needs to know about that. In terms of other side effects, you know, different than EV, has a bit more in the way of GI toxicity, so nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, a bit more in the way of cytopenias than EV, but we don't see the neuropathy, for instance. We don't see the rash. So different side effect profile.
Could you just elaborate a little bit more about the acute issues, and then we'll talk more about the ILD. But, you know, initially the idea of antibody drug conjugate, everybody thought, oh, you know, they're not going to have any toxicities. And then you start to realize that some of this does get out into the circulation. And actually T-DXd is considered, I think, a highly emetogenic drug and managed that way, and not necessarily that easy.
Yeah, so absolutely. So there's certainly side effects that are chemotherapy-like side effects with this drug. It's chemotherapy. And I completely agree that this notion that these were going to be magic bullets, such that the side effect profile was going to be much better than standard cytotoxic drugs, that hasn't really materialized. I think what has materialized is that for the most part, these classes of drugs just work a lot better than standard cytotoxic treatment, but not necessarily much better tolerated.
And another thing we've seen is that you see one ADC better than another. You know, in breast cancer, they did a randomized trial of T-DXd versus the prior HER2 ADC, TDM1, and it just blew it away. Not even, which people were really surprised at because they always viewed them as the same. Here's some of the data that's really stoked some of this interest. You know, these one-arm basket trials, and you look over there in the middle, and you see bladder. And I was talking to a very prominent urologic investigator who said, oh, it was only 41 patients. But, you know, Matt, that's in the background of a lot of, you see across the board there, 37, 58, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that we saw in breast cancer that seems to be happening is really good responses, longer durations. Is that what you're seeing with UBC, Matt?
It is, absolutely. And I think that's a good point that you bring up, because one could have said the same thing about some of the basket studies with therapies directed against the kinase domain of HER2. But in fact, you didn't see that. You saw that responses occurred in certain malignancies and not others. Whereas here, using HER2 as a target for selective delivery of cytotoxic agents, you're really seeing that the efficacy is lining up across tumor types.
So, can I make a comment from a urology perspective as well?
Because,
since we have several urologists on the call. So obviously we're talking about this in the advanced metastatic second line, third line setting. But for the longest time, we as urologists have been interested in HER2, right? Because it drives micropapillary disease. And micropapillary histology is one thing that, even if it's non-invasive, doesn't respond to intravesical therapy with BCG. So the usual recommendation is consider early radical cystectomy. So we don't have the trials, you know, to talk about yet, but from a urologist standpoint, be interested in this field because you never know when these are going to move. I don't think the systemic drug will move into non-invasive disease, but the ADC might, right? And you might have a patient that has micropapillary histology. You do your HER2 staining, and Matt touched upon the extracellular, intracellular. That's a lot more complex in bladder. And, you know, we've been part of publications showing that there's a lot more intracellular domain alterations in HER2 in bladder cancer than in the other cancers. But be aware of HER2, because you as a urologist might be doing intravesical therapy with an HER2 agent in the near future.
And you will see data from some of the available drugs in patients with micropapillary disease coming out.
Wow, that is, I knew nothing about that whatsoever. Very interesting. But here's the big story. I mean, this is really important. First of all, I'd recognize the importance of looking for this and what it might mean to a patient. But there's also, and you know, that whole story is really interesting, compelling, and important. But this is just as important. And I think a urologist can have just as important an effect in a patient with advanced disease, with metastatic disease, by saying, hey, it's not normal for you to be short of breath right, or, you know, have a coughing right now. You need that looked into, as an example. So Matt, we talked about the issue of, you know, overall tolerability. Seems to be certainly better tolerated than cisplatin chemotherapy, that's for sure. But then we get into the real world issue of interstitial lung disease. And I'd like you to kind of reiterate what your platform is right now to try to deal with that, how to screen for it, and what to do when a patient develops ILD on TDXD, and how the grade affects that.
So we're scanning pretty frequently. We scan these patients pretty frequently, given the line of treatment that this is. And so we're scanning them, you know, every 3 cycles, every 9 weeks. And so we're monitoring for this pretty closely because we do standard imaging of the lungs when we do our restaging evaluations. You know, any ground glass opacities that develop on treatment, we take quite seriously and have the luxury of pulmonologists who have been involved in the development of guidelines for managing ILD from ADCs, and so are really attuned to what to look for and when patients might start to get into trouble. So we refer patients pretty early, hold treatment pretty early, and then, of course, initiate steroids when things are starting to get worse.
So, Ashish, any thoughts? And also, this paper actually done by the Dana-Farber Breast Division kind of has a cool little way to think about this, the 5S rules, screen and scan, that Matt just referred to, working together as an interdisciplinary team. But the key one here, I think, is when to stop treatment. And what they want to do is stop it before it gets symptomatic. So grade 1. Right. If they get to grade 2, usually they're not going to restart it in breast. And I think everybody's kind of following along. Also, the use of steroids that Matt just mentioned, but also looking at how long it takes them to respond. Do they completely respond in 28 days or not affected? So they have a pretty sophisticated algorithm, but I think just to be aware of this could be helpful. But what are your thoughts, Ashish?
No, I agree. I mean, I learn stuff from Matt all the time, and today's no exception, right? But for anybody that's taking care of bladder cancer patients, you need to be aware of all of this, because as you said, the patient may not even call the referred medical oncologist's office. They may call the urologist's office and say, I'm having a little shortness of breath. And you don't want to attribute that to, in the past, what you thought was anemia, right? You want to actually take it seriously. So you need to know all of this for sure.
And if you want to see a really, really sad doctor and patient, you'll look at a patient who does develop grade 2 disease but's had a great response. And, you know, of course, some of these people, the response will continue, but really it could have been avoided in many instances by more aggressive screening. So we talked about another HER2 ADC, dasatamab vedotin. Matt. Again, really exciting looking data here. Great looking waterfall plot. I guess tolerability, what we would expect with a Vedotin delivery system. Any thoughts about where this is going to head, and if it does come to practice, how it'll interact with TDXD?
So trastuzumab, deruxtecan, disitamab, vedotin, different, very different ADCs. Trastuzumab, deruxtecan, as it sounds like, the antibody is trastuzumab. With disitamab, it's a different antibody directed against a different epitope to HER2, and the payloads are different as well. Disitamab vedotin was initially developed in Asia, RC48. There were phase two studies done, multiple phase two studies showing a good amount of activity in patients with pretreated urothelial cancer in the metastatic setting. And based on that promising activity, the drug was acquired by Seagen, and now there are a large international phase two study trying to recapitulate the results that were seen previously. And then a phase three study has been launched as well, combining disitamab vedotin plus pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy. That's an international study. So I think the positioning of this drug will depend in part by one, what happens with the phase three study, and two, whether or not we're seeing a subgroup of patients with very high levels of HER2 expression who benefit particularly from this approach. Given that we have EV Pembro, is there a specific population who's really going to benefit more from a HER2-directed approach? I think that's going to be defined by the clinical trials.
And of course, adding IO is going to be in there. So Ashish, I've got this really great question about this muscle thing I'm saving for the end, just to keep the urologists listening. But anyway, I want to get your take on another topic that was brought up to me by Dr. Hafrin. And frankly, almost every solid tumor conference we do, somebody brings this up. Here's Dr. Hafrin.
That's a big issue, the CTCs. A lot of people are using that based on the atezolizumab trial, which was a negative trial, but showed a correlation with CTCs. If you don't see circulating tumor cells, should a patient have adjuvant therapy, or should the patient be considered for immunotherapy? Is there a difference in the providers or the labs? When do you test the tissue? Do you test it at initial diagnosis? And which labs do you prefer? Are they all equal? And when you order the tissue testing, is there any special request that you need to put in to make sure you get all the information required? How are you using circulating tumor cells today with bladder cancer? Are you using it post-surgery? Are you using it pre-surgery? How does that help you guide therapy?
So Ashish, I think he's referring to cell-free DNA there, obviously. And this is, you know, I'm curious what your thoughts in the perioperative setting. I'm curious what Matt's thoughts are about that as well as the metastatic setting. But Ashish, do you think this is relevant today? Are you looking at this?
Relevant, absolutely. Looking at it, absolutely. And the ctDNA, so, and I'm just for those that are listening that might not be aware, there's tumor informed and tumor uninformed, right? We're talking about tumor informed, so the actual commercial Signatera test, and that's what we use. And the most amount of data is really based on that, and that's in the IMvigor10. I mean, it's all the stuff that Matt's going to talk about. But is it ready for prime time use from our perspective? No. I mean, I'll just put that out there. So we're looking at it wherever all the trials that look at whether how you stratify patients moving forward. There's some in the pre-cystectomy setting, and I don't want to steal Matt's thunder, but I use it to sort of gauge which patients I would recommend something for strongly or less strongly, but I let them know it's still experimental and I can't make actual recommendations unless the results of the trials are available. But it is certainly something that everyone should be aware of.
So, Matt, any thoughts? Do you ever use it metastatic disease? A lot of investigators echo Ashish's thoughts across tumor lines, you know, where this is being used, you know, the hold off on the trials. It is being used very actively and supported in colon cancer. But then I hear people using the investigators, docs in practice, lots of people using it, cell-free DNA in the metastatic, oligometastatic, et cetera, et cetera. So do we need to keep waiting for these trials, Matt?
So I think it's a very interesting and helpful tool. I think we've established clinical validation in certain disease states of bladder cancer, but not yet established clinical utility. And we need studies. We need prospective studies to do that. And I'll just give a plug for the modern study, NCI-sponsored, Alliance study. patients post-cystectomy. Detectable ctDNA are randomized to an immunotherapy doublet versus standard of care adjuvant nivolumab. Patients who are ctDNA negative are randomized to standard of care adjuvant nivolumab versus surveillance, and those patients can initiate nivolumab if they have conversion of undetectable to detectable ctDNA. In the metastatic setting, there is an indication for Signatera for immunotherapy monitoring. I have to say we have it done sometimes because patients have had it done in the adjuvant setting and then unfortunately develop metastatic disease. And once in a while, it does really contribute to interpretation of scans that are somewhat equivocal. So I think it's going to be useful across all lines of treatment, all clinical disease states, but we do need the data to establish clinical utility.
Actually, another question just popped up in the chat room. Maybe I'll throw out to you, Matt, from Adley. Any future for Nevo Gem Cis as first-line therapy metastatic disease? We saw that as a positive trial, but then EV Pembro came along and nobody kind of paid much. I don't think. It was a positive trial, but what were your thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, so Gem Cis Nevo, survival benefit compared to Gem Cis. High complete clinical response rates, 20%, median duration of clinical complete response, 36 months. And so this is a regimen that's quite active. And remember, with this regimen, it's a fixed duration of treatment. So 6 cycles of Gem Cis and then maintenance immunotherapy for a fixed duration. It's very different than the way that we give EV Pembro. So whether or not there are some patients for whom that's attractive and for whom that should be considered, I think these are considerations. And as Ashish pointed out, in terms of the availability, the accessibility of treatment, this is one of those factors that might weigh into decisions about which regimen to administer.
Okay, here's the question from Demetrius. I think he's been waiting to be able to throw this. That he wants you, Ashish, to specifically answer. TURB reveals a papillary high grade urothelial carcinoma measuring 2.1 centimeters, invading through the lamina propria without lymphovascular invasion. The detrusor layer was represented and not involved in disease, end quote. The correct answer to this question was to repeat the biopsy. The logic is that these lesions are, quote, converted to muscle invasive disease. I'm just translating this from the urology.
Okay, I didn't see a question at the question mark at the end. On the board, the right answer is to, yes, go back and do another resection. That's what he put in the guidelines. There are nuances, though, right? I mean, if it's a smaller tumor and it's an expert resection, et cetera, and you're confident your pathologist is actually giving you all the information, we don't always take that patient back. But if whoever asked the question is sitting for the boards tomorrow and you answer you didn't take the patient back, we would fail you.
All right. Okay, so this has been very helpful and interesting to me, that's for sure. And I'm sure our webinar on Wednesday on targeted therapy non-small cell will be equally interesting. You may not have known there was actually a virtual ASCO like a couple weeks ago on KRAS, new KRAS G12C drug. So anyhow, we'll try to get you caught up on that right before we get to the ASCO meeting. And Matt and Ashish, thank you so much for working with us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. We'll see you Wednesday night at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you.